May it please the Court.
Good morning, Your Honors. Peter Walsh on behalf of the defendant, appellant IAC Interactive. Before I make my remarks, I'd like to introduce Edward Ferguson, who is the Vice President and Associate General Counsel of IAC.
Welcome.
And also seated at counsel's table is my colleague at Potter Anderson, Scott Zerwanka.
Welcome.
I've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. As the Court is aware, we've raised two issues for appeal, and they would be the statute of limitations argument, as well as the whether the Court of Chancery erred in allowing what we've described as the premium or success fees. And given the limited amount of time, I'm going to pass over the issue of the premium fees. Obviously, in doing so, we don't waive that claim. We will stand on our briefs for purposes of that that particular claim. And we would urge the Court, to the extent it does not find that the claim is time-barred, that it disallow those premium fees. I would like to spend a couple of minutes speaking to the accrual question, because I think it's a critically important issue in this case. And as this Court observed in the Scharf versus Edgecombe Corporation matter, it's imperative in any statute of limitations case to identify the accrual date of the claim. And I'd like to spend just two or three minutes identifying that claim and when it accrued against my client, IAC. As the Court is aware, there was a what the briefs refer to as a PRC, of Altus arbitration, commenced in, I believe it was perhaps 2003, and that's the source of Mr. O'Brien's indemnification claim against IAC. And in that case, PRC, his former employer, asserted claims against him, and he countered with claims and also asserted affirmative employment-related claims, because in connection with that litigation, his employment with PRC was terminated. And by contract, the arbitration was one in which the resolution was final and binding. And in January 2005, a panel of three arbitrators decided that PRC was not entitled to recover against Mr. O'Brien, and Mr. O'Brien was not entitled to recover against PRC. And importantly, the arbitration panel made another important finding which has significance for this case, and that was, as between the two, there was no prevailing party and neither was entitled to their attorney's fees or expenses. And so to the extent that any party to that arbitration sought to challenge it, it had 90 days to do so, even assuming it could do so, because it was very limited in terms of the basis for a challenge. Essentially, it had to be attorney misconduct. And there's no dispute in this case that no party to the arbitration challenged it. Okay? And so as of April 19th, and that would have been 90 days after the last arbitrator signed the award, the underlying arbitration in this matter, which is the source of Mr. O'Brien's claim, became final and conclusive. There could be no challenge to that arbitration. And at that point, Mr. O'Brien had a ripe indemnification claim against PRC and against IAC. And there are several things in the record which the Court can look to make it perfectly clear that Mr. O'Brien and his counsel understood that as of April 2005, he had a final claim which he could pursue against either PRC or IAC. There's a February 23, 2005 demand in the record where he wrote to PRC and said, I was successful on the merits in the arbitration, and notwithstanding the arbitrator's decision not to award attorney's fees, I'm entitled as a matter of right under my contract, Florida law, the certificate of incorporation. In March of 2005, he moved in a Florida trial court for summary judgment on his indemnification claim, again, having been, in his view, successful on the merits, notwithstanding the arbitrator's decision. And then in June of 2005, and I think most significantly, he amended his complaint in the Florida trial court, which was originally brought as an employment-related claim, to make it very clear he was entitled to indemnification against PRC because of his indemnification agreement, Florida law, which in many ways is similar to our law on the issue of indemnification in 145C, and by reason of the certificate of incorporation. And importantly, and I think this is the critical point in this and why this is dispositive, at that time, Mr. O'Brien recognized that not only did he have an indemnification claim, but he had two sources of indemnification, PRC and its parent, IAC, my client. IAC, because in the 2000 merger agreement in which it acquired PRC, it had expressly assumed the indemnification obligation under Mr. O'Brien's indemnification agreement.
Well, in this case, the Court of Chancery concluded that the date you picked was not the controlling date, in part because the litigation issue of indemnification continued in Florida beyond that date. Isn't that what it said?
Yeah, and I think that's the source of confusion. It wasn't, and I think purposely there was a source of confusion as between the accrual date, which that the claim accrued when the arbitration was finally binding and over, and the defense that PR asserted to that claim once it was before the Florida trial court. And I think what's important here is the Florida trial court dealt with a ripe claim. In other words, the defense asserted there by PRC was, you don't have a right claim because there's still some less than finality to this arbitration. The defense that PR asserted in the trial court was, Mr. O'Brien, you stipulated that all issues relating to attorney's fees and expenses would be decided by the arbitrators. Therefore, you've waived that right. It wasn't, you don't have a right claim. The claim had accrued. And so had Mr. O'Brien been inclined to do so, he could have sued IAC at the same time and said, I have a right claim, I prevailed on the merits, I'm entitled to attorney's fees.
Well, do you agree that the Court of Chancery at least recited the applicable law correctly? Is it your position that it was misapplied? Because didn't the Vice Chancellor find that there were unusual circumstances here that justified not applying the statute of limitations?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me speak to where we believe the Court of Chancery erred. The Court of Chancery resuscitated what I believe the Court in its heart of hearts felt was an untimely claim. And he did so on the basis of latches. And our position is that from day one, this was a legal claim. This was a claim based upon a contract. It was brought in the Court of Chancery because the 2000 merger agreement required Delaware, applied Delaware law and required the case be brought in Delaware, and it was brought in Chancery by reason of 145C. As this Court knows, prior to 1994, when 145K was inserted, this case would have been heard in the Superior Court, and there would have been no latches argument to be made. And our position before the Court of Chancery was, since 2002, when this Court decided Stiefel Financial, it held that in indemnification cases, because they are fundamentally contract cases, the statute of limitation applies. Absent unusual circumstances. And our position on this is we're not suggesting that the Court needs to conclude that in any contract case the Court can never apply latches. Our position is very simple, that under controlling law, given that this was a legal claim, the proper analysis would have been for the Court to say, is this case time-barred? There's a presumption of untimeliness if Mr. O'Brien didn't bring his claim within 3 years. And there isn't any question he didn't bring his claim within 3 years. Then the question would have been, is there any basis to excuse the presumption of untimeliness? And our position is very clear. He knew about his claim against IAC in April of 2005. He had 3 years to bring it. He elected not to bring it because as a matter of cost, convenience, and likelihood of recovery, he decided to pursue one potential claimant as opposed to two.
Is it correct that the underlying contract was made under Florida law?
The underlying contract was made under Florida law.
What is Florida's statute of limitations for a breach of that contract?
5 years, Your Honor.
Why isn't that the statute that applies here?
Because the Mr. O'Brien's contract right arises under the 2000 merger agreement. He was, in essence, a third-party beneficiary, which expressly applies Delaware law and requires the claim to be brought in Delaware.
Well, it requires that a claim be brought in Delaware. Does it require that Delaware law apply?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, under Delaware law, as you know, the forum law applies unless there's some basis to apply Florida law, and in this case, under the borrowing statute, the court would apply the law of the jurisdiction, Delaware, 3 years, and not apply the longer 5-year limitation.
So even though the contract originated in Florida, And one could argue that the expectation of the original parties would be that it would be interpreted under Florida law.
Yes, to the extent that he was seeking to enforce his contract in Florida. But the problem is his fundamental right, and the court below decided this, his fundamental right arose under a contract, the 2000 merger agreement, which expressly applied Delaware law, and any right he had under that contract to be brought in Delaware.
I thought the merger contract simply said, we assume the obligations that previously undertaken by PRC.
Yes, that's in essence.
And that obligation wasn't a Florida contract with Mr. O'Brien?
It was a Florida contract. But again, in Delaware, to the extent he had to bring the claim in Delaware, and I suppose he could have asserted a claim against IAC in Florida, perhaps then the five-year limitation would have applied, but he didn't. He had to bring it in Delaware, and the law is very clear that it's a three-year statute of limitations because the law of the forum applies. Notwithstanding that an argument could be made, I don't think forcefully, I don't think there was any authority cited in his favor that Florida law would apply, because his right, to the extent he had a right against IAC, arose under a Delaware contract and had to be brought in a Delaware court.
All right.
The Vice-Chancellor found that unusual predicament here. He said O'Brien effectively was precluded in the interim from receiving indemnification from PRC or IAC under the doctrines of res judicata and collateral estoppel, respectively, for 14 months.
Yes.
Is that wrong?
That's absolutely wrong, Your Honor. That argument is absolutely, and that goes to the confusion. There's a difference between when a claim accrues and whether you're successful on that claim in a court. If the court was right about that, Mr. O'Brien would not have had a right claim until he actually prevailed on it in the Florida court, and that's not right. Again, the claim accrued when the arbitration came to a final binding conclusion.
But
what happened
apart from accrual, doesn't this language support a finding of unusual circumstances?
It does not, Your Honor, because Mr. O'Brien always had the right to pursue a claim against IEC. And the fact that he elected to proceed against one potential claimant as opposed to two doesn't get him off the hook with respect to his statute of limitations, which is continuing to run against the other party.
Well, your position is that, whatever claim Mr. O'Brien had against, PRC, it also had against IRC.
IAC, correct.
Let me just get at the same problem that I believe Justice Ridgely was trying to explore, but in a different route. Your position is that this case was brought in the Court of Chancery. The Court of Chancery is a court of equity, has the power to apply latches as opposed to the statute of limitations as a principle of time bar, correct?
Correct.
But you also argue that that power is not unbounded. It has to be bounded by some principle, and the principle here is that the statute, that since the claim is a legal claim, the statute should apply absent unusual circumstances.
Correct.
Here there are no unusual circumstances. It might be different if it were a claim against a fiduciary or there was some abuse of legal power that might make the application of the statute unfair. But we don't have that here.
Correct.
That's correct,
yes.
All right. But what we do have is a determination by a Florida court, which was the law of the case and binding on everybody for 14 months, that there was no claim against PRC, which had to mean that there was no claim against anybody else. Why would that not operate as a tolling principle?
Well, again,
yes, it may be that the claim accrued in April of 2005,
mm-hmm.
That would mean that it would the suit would have to be filed against IAC by July. By April of 2008.
Correct.
But here we had for 14 months, you know, a ruling that ineffectively held that there was no claim at all. You know, if why would that not, by analogy to tolling principles, either toll the claim or, if it didn't, operate as an unfair result?
Your Honor, I don't know of any authority which suggests that that would operate as a tolling event, because it's the claim has already accrued, and the fact that you pursue a claim against one party and are unsuccessful, again, doesn't stop the statute of limitations. It may be unfair in the sense that you elected to pursue that claim in that court and were unsuccessful, but it doesn't stop the running of the statute of limitations. And again, the question is, if you've taken your chances and it doesn't work out for you in Florida, and let's say the Florida claim, it remained pending until past the 3 years, and then only then did the court rule against Mr. O'Brien, he still would have been out of luck.
So you're arguing that even though there was a binding order, at least for 14 months, that in effect held that Mr. O'Brien had no claim, he was obligated on penalty of forfeiture to go to Delaware and sue IAC, where he would be met, that is, where I guess he would be met with the argument that undoubtedly your side would be making, that the Florida court had already decided this.
Yes, and the reason we say that, Your Honor, is because simply by filing the claim, and it doesn't stop the accrual time, except as to those parties who are before the court. And there's no principled basis where you can pursue one party and spend your time litigating that, and then if you ultimately lose, turn around and say, now I get to try somebody else. If the time has run, the time has run. That was an election that Mr. O'Brien made. He could have stopped the clock against IAC, but he elected not to, knowing in 2005 that he had that claim. He had that right.
In other words, you're saying what he should have done was to sue in Delaware, and they agreed to a stay until the Florida courts decided one way or the other the merits of the Florida litigation.
Exactly. Or sued IAC in Florida, in which case IAC would have had to have made a decision. Do we force him to sue in Delaware, or do we not want to be involved in two separate cases and just appear in Florida and waive the forum selection clause, which parties have a right to do? But that's what he should have done to arrest the limitations period.
Do you want to save the balance?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Mark Gregory, and it's a privilege to represent Mr. O'Brien before this court. In effect, what IAC is arguing is that Mr. O'Brien should have commenced duplicative and futile litigation during the period of time the law of the case was that he didn't have these rights. And, you know, that would indeed be a bizarre result, and certainly not one supported by any precedent of the court.
But on what legal principle does that argument rest? That is, that why should it make a difference? Even after the Florida appellate court undid the order of the Florida trial court, your client had 3 months to come to Delaware and sue IAC, and yet that wasn't done.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the earliest accrual date for the case against IAC on the obligation was when the Florida Court of Appeals issued its ruling. So I believe that April 19 is not an appropriate accrual date. But the earliest accrual date is December 2006. Now, as I understood the argument this morning,
when was the accrual date?
December 2006. When, for the first time.
Then your client could theoretically have waited for 3 years beyond that, and yet it sued only 3 months, I believe, after the statute of limitations expired if one credits the other side's accrual date.
Well, if he sued within weeks of the bankruptcy court in New York confirming the plan of reorganization, and only at that time did it become firm and certain that he was not going to get his recovery from PRC. Now, it sounded this morning that IAC has abandoned, you know, the principal argument that it made in its briefs, that the Court of Chancery didn't have the authority to apply the laches principles. And, of course, when the legislature conferred upon the Chancery Court the exclusive jurisdiction, it did so knowing that the Court of Chancery was a court in equity and had various equitable powers. And to suggest that in this one particular type of case, not all of the court's ordinary powers would apply is not something that I find any authority for whatsoever. Now, the distinctions that...
Well, the laches doctrine traditionally has been applied as a defense against equitable claims, mm-hmm. not legal claims.
Well, but it's been, as this court in Reed, which is a case, a derivative action case, but the underlying causes of action were legal causes of action. The damages sought were legal damages, and this court specifically instructed that the laches principles be applied to determine the timeliness of that case. And the laches principles are neutral. They don't say...
No, but why... I don't have the facts of that case in mind. Was that a purely legal contractual claim for damages?
It was a breach of joint venture agreement claim.
Joint ventures are fiduciaries.
It was a breach of contract case, is my understanding of both this court's decision and the Chancery Court's decision. And the law with respect to laches doesn't operate just one way to shorten time periods. It can also be used to lengthen time periods. It depends on the facts and circumstances of each case.
Well, the concern here is that the court, while it may have the power to apply a laches principle instead of the statute, can't just willy-nilly decide on an ad hoc basis whether to do that. There has to be some principled basis.
Yes, Your Honor. There has to
be. What are you suggesting is the principled basis here?
Well, there are. It can only be applied when there are unusual conditions and exceptional circumstances, which I think Your Honor identified already this morning, the fact that for a long period of time, Mr. O'Brien both was given rights and taken rights away by virtue of the arbitration award and the way the Florida court interpreted that arbitration award. And it is certainly counterintuitive to think that a statute of limitations clock can be ticking on a cause of action which a court of competent jurisdiction has ruled in a final judgment does not exist. Your Honor was right that if there is no claim against PRC, there was no claim against IAC. And had a claim been brought against IAC during the period of time that that was the law of the case, there is no question that it would have been met with a motion to dismiss on res judicata or collateral estoppel grounds or alternatively stayed.
So why is that an unusual circumstance that justifies applying laches rather than the statute of limitations?
Because two reasons, Your Honor. Number one, because an accrual date is tied to when does the indemnity
Can you have, speak more into the mic? And
I'm
having trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry. My wife tells me that as well. The accrual date begins when the indemnity is reasonably certain that he has such rights. And with the Court of Florida ruling that he has no such rights, it was impossible for him to be certain of those rights. That follows as a matter of course. So for a period of time of 14 months, the law of the case was he had no rights. He had no rights to sue. So that period of time should not operate against him.
What does that mean? I mean, are we talking tolling, or are we just talking unfairness?
Well, we are talking unusual circumstances, unusual conditions, and exceptional circumstances.
Not tolling.
I'm sorry?
We're not. You're not arguing that this is a tolling principle.
Well, for it to be tolling would be to assume that the cause of action already accrued. And as I said, I believe that the earliest the cause of action accrued was in December 2006, when
Your client may have believed it, but what if that's wrong?
Well, then, you know, these are the unusual circumstances that warrant the application of the latches principles.
Namely
the fact that the law of the case was that he didn't have the rights, which until December 2006, it wasn't confirmed that he did indeed have the rights. The Florida litigation, in effect, served as a continuation of the arbitration because, as Mr. Walsh indicated, the grounds for challenging the arbitration award in Florida were extremely limited. So this in effect, continued, it addressed the open issue left by the arbitration panel.
I want to make sure I understand this statute of limitations, tolling, latches issue. If I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that this is a legal claim under general principles of latches. The court will follow the statute of limitations unless there are circumstances that warrant not following the statute of limitations. And that while the time period during which the claim was decided against your client wouldn't be a technical tolling of the statute of limitations because there was nothing to prevent him from filing the suit, it has a similar import to a tolling of the statute of limitations, so that when a court of equity looks to the statute of limitations but doesn't have to follow it, the court of equity can also look to what is in the nature of a tolling and apply that principle.
That's correct, Your Honor. And of course, the additional factor with respect to Latches' principles is, has there been prejudice to the defendant in, you know, whatever delay there may have been in bringing the suit? And here, IAC does not even argue. It concedes that there was no prejudice. It knew about Mr. O'Brien from the outset, and it concedes that it was the one directing the nature of the defense.
So in your view, Latches is not a principle that applies when a party has done something or failed to do something that's harmful to the other side, and therefore the normal statute of limitations wouldn't apply because of that party's actions. It can just happen as a result of what a court does somewhere, or happen as a result of what the party who's asserting latches chose to do or not do. It doesn't have apparently any impact on what the party against whom latches is asserted has done or not done. Is that true?
I think in this case, of course, IAC was very active in directing the defense and causing the very reason for the activities in Florida.
Well, what I'm thinking of is if you're going to assert latches against the party, isn't there an understanding in equity that the party against whom you assert it has affirmatively tried to cause another party harm, or has failed to do something that a person or an entity acting in good faith would have done, and the result of either the omission or the act is harm to the party who's asserting latches? What did IAC do here except through PRC or itself simply defend itself against a Florida action?
Well, it refused to honor Mr. O'Brien's obligations, and it was well aware. I don't think it is a necessary element of latches that the party undertakes some affirmative act. You know, certainly it is an element that is relevant.
More importantly, if all the party is doing is asserting its own rights, mm-hmm. in a bona fide court of with appropriate jurisdiction, how does that create an unfairness to the other party who didn't act and now wants to rely on latches?
Well, at the same token, it doesn't create any it didn't create any prejudice to IAC either. IAC was well aware of what Mr. O'Brien's rights were.
Okay. Refused. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. My point goes to, why is latches involved with this at all? Because there is a contract breach that we're talking about. There is a statute of limitations. What is the evil act that latches is being asserted to prevent?
I wouldn't characterize it as an evil act. What I would characterize it is latches is addressing the fact that for over a year, Mr. O'Brien was told that he was told by a court of law that he had no such rights. And so latches is being used here to address the fact that during that period of time and for that period of time, he did not undertake what would have been duplicative and futile litigation.
I guess another way of exploring this point is to say I can understand that as an assertion that the statute of limitations should be told. I have difficulty understanding how latches as an equitable theory mm-hmm. comes into play here in the absence of bad conduct on a party's part. Mm-hmm. Why does equity kick in? Because equity is only supposed to kick into the stream of things when the law is inadequate to handle the dispute, which is at its heart a legal dispute.
Mm-hmm. And what I say, Your Honor, is that as Vice Chancellor Parsons found, there was an uncertainty in the arbitration award. Continued litigation in the Florida court served as really a continuation of the arbitration, and that uncertainty was not resolved until December 2006. So the period of time where, in most cases, it is certainly true that the end of the underlying activity triggers the accrual date for an indemnification rights. And the reason for that is because in most cases it's clear whether the indemnity has such rights at that time or doesn't have such rights at that time. That was not the case here. And as I said, the Florida trial court entered final judgment saying that that was not the case here.
Let me be perfectly candid here. Why shouldn't I conclude that Vice Chancellor Parsons simply didn't like the result here, so he trotted out latches as an equitable principle to get around the statute of limitations? He thought the result was unfair. But apart from a feeling that the result was unfair, what's his principled basis for trotting out latches in a basic breach of contract claim where the legislature says the statute of limitations in Delaware is 3 years?
Well, obviously, I can't explore what was in his mind. What I can say is
that... Well, we do that by looking at his findings of mm-hmm. fact and his legal rationale
right.
for coming to the result he did.
And from analyzing his opinion, it appears that what he concluded is that Mr. O'Brien was in this period where his claim was both too early and too late, and that... he could have gone further, certainly, and said, in addition to finding that the claim is not time-barred by virtue of the principles of latches, it is also not time-barred by the statute of limitations. And as Your Honor noted earlier, this was an underlying Florida contract. The merger agreement by which IAC assumed both responsibility for performing and the responsibility for causing PRC to perform required them to perform these contracts in accordance with their terms.
And didn't Vice Chancellor Parsons really focus on the unusual circumstances? Because to the extent the other side argues they should have filed suit in Delaware against IAC during this 14-month interval, there would have been a real Rule 11 problem with the lawyer who filed a complaint for indemnification in light of an adjudication in Florida that there was no claim for indemnification.
There's no question that the defense IAC would have made would have been a very aggressive one, saying that this case has no merit whatsoever because take a look at the decision of the Florida trial court.
So while it's couched in latches, and I assume you don't have a preference whether you prevail on tolling or latches, what I'm focusing on are the unusual circumstances and what seems to have influenced Vice Chancellor Parsons' decision is that this is a very unusual case where you're supposed to be asserting claims that have accrued at the same time they've been litigated against you.
Correct. Correct. And notwithstanding what Mr. Walsh said this morning, I think we can look at the record of what the positions IAC took in the Florida court and took it before the Vice Chancellor, and indeed there are hints of it in their briefing here, that if you had asked on April 20 whether a cause of action in favor of Mr. O'Brien for indemnification had accrued the day before, you know, clearly the answer it would have given would have been no.
And that's the position they took in the Florida courts, that
yes,
it might have accrued, but we don't even admit that you have a cause of action.
Correct. Correct. I'd like to just briefly touch on the fee issue, unless there's any other questions with respect to the timeliness point. The alternative fee arrangements would not have been necessary had the advancements been provided from the outset. This case goes back to December 2002. It's been a long odyssey for Mr. O'Brien. And while you know he has had some financial successes in his life, the relative balance between the resources that he enjoys and the resources enjoyed by IAC, a behemoth of a company that made it very clear that it intended to pursue its vindictive campaign against him virtually at no cost, created a great imbalance. And he would not have been able to continue the litigation had alternative fee arrangements not been made with this counsel.
The problem we have is that the type of contingent fee arrangement that was made here, might be a non-issue if we were talking about someone who was truly impoverished in the sense that they would not be able to retain a lawyer to prosecute the case. That wasn't your client's problem. Your client simply didn't want to expend the money that would be required to prosecute the case on an hourly basis. That was a choice that that he made. The question is, why should that choice and the fee consequences of it be binding upon a third party that had no opportunity to negotiate that arrangement?
I think it's important to bear in mind, Your Honor. I'm sorry, that Mr. O'Brien had already expended nearly $1 million, had fallen behind in his payments on the eve of the final preparations for the arbitration, on the eve of the arbitration itself, which, as the record reveals, was extensive, lengthy, and expensive. So while he was not destitute, certainly continuing to defend himself against this campaign, could very well have made him destitute. And but for the fact that his lawyers stepped up, chose not to abandon him, and made an arrangement by which they would get an extra amount of fee for on their hourly time is entirely reasonable, and certainly this is not a de novo issue either. The court below found those fees to be reasonable. I think it's important to remember, for example, with respect to the Kelly Drive fee, that agreement was made at the absolute nadir of this odyssey that Mr. O'Brien has gone through. That agreement was made after the Florida trial court rendered its final judgment against him. So at that point in time, there certainly was no clear likelihood of success. And here we are in 2011, and fees that were incurred in 2005 still have not been paid. So, you know, it would be fundamentally unfair to punish counsel and Mr. O'Brien for putting him in a position where it was the only way he was ultimately able to vindicate the rights, which we now know as of December 2006, he truly did have.
So you're saying the record shows that your client was falling behind on his legal fees and he was having a financial problem?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was presented to the Vice Chancellor?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did the Vice Chancellor rely on that as a basis for awarding the premium portion of the fee?
I don't recall whether he recited that in his decision or not. But certainly it was one of the important facts that were presented to him, both in the record and during the oral argument. Let's see, the yellow light has come on, so I sum up by asking the court to affirm the Vice Chancellor's decision in all respects. An affirmance does not require the court to make any new law. It simply requires the court to follow the principles and precedents that already exist. And to the contrary, I believe the IAC's positions would require the court to create new law that would be counterintuitive and counter to the interests of the important public policy that indemnification is designed to serve. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Briefly on the issue of tolling, I think it should be pointed out that at no time did Mr. O'Brien either plead or even raise in the briefing below or here any issue of tolling. It was never a question of tolling. And certainly had he raised that, we would have had an opportunity to refute it. And again, what I've heard is that essentially because he was in limbo land, he gets a free pass on the statute of limitations as against a party he elected not to pursue.
What you'll position find no did authority. IAC take in the Florida litigation?
IAC was not a party in the Florida litigation. It was the parent company. There isn't any question it knew about the litigation. It was aware of what was going on in the litigation, but it was never joined as a party. In fact, Mr. O'Brien and Mr. Gregory had made the assertion that it was as a result of the position IAC took in Florida that it should be that somehow the statute of limitations should be bypassed. You will find in the record that the first demand made upon IAC as opposed to PRC was in March 2008.
I know. I'm looking for what record evidence do we have that IAC was influencing, controlling, having input in the Florida litigation as a parent?
In the record, I think there is discussions about involvement of IAC. IAC was a party in the arbitration, and again, PRC was operated as an autonomous company, but given the control issue, there isn't any question it was, again, aware of. I believe it shared the same counsel, at least in the arbitration. But the control issue really doesn't get Mr. O'Brien anywhere. That was presented to the court on the point of on the issue of prejudice. In essence, this was a case where latches typically is asserted by a defendant. This is a case where the plaintiff came in saying latches. And our position to the court below and to this position is you don't get to prejudice unless you explain why the presumptive unreasonableness of failing to comply with the statute of limitations is explained. And here, the only explanation that we have is He made an election to pursue one potential claimant to the exclusion of another, and when he realized in January of 2008 that maybe he wasn't going to be able to recover, he shifted focus, knowing all along that back in April 2005 he had a claim against that company.
Do you think that if a complaint had been filed in Delaware against IAC during this 14-month interval, that there might have been Rule 11 problems for the lawyer who filed it?
No, Your Honor, because he could have said, I'm filing this to preserve my right and claim against IAC, regardless of whether or not I win in Florida. And if I lose in Florida, I have a right of appeal, which he took. So clearly, the court could have said, this case, which people do all the time, by the way, file complaints to preserve their rights so they don't waive the statute of limitations. Certainly, he could have done that. And in response to a motion to dismiss, he could have argued that this was done to preserve his claim against IAC because he believed he had a claim against IAC, just like he believed he had that in 2005. Mr. Gregory has also said that the claim accrued, I believe he said, in December of 2006. As this court has recognized, and Scharf being one example, there's only one accrual date. You don't get multiple steps along the way based upon events that have occurred. It starts at one time.
Well, on the subject of accrual, since we're limited here time-wise, does the record show your client made Mr. O'Brien aware of its position that the accrual date was April of 2005?
April of 2005. I don't think there's anything in the record to that effect. In other words, there isn't some letter or notice that, oh, by the way, the time for your claim against IAC has started to tick. I don't think there's anything like that in the record.
So they weren't proceeding in the face of a position that you had taken, you know, during the events in question?
No, they weren't. But what they did know and what is in the record is that Mr. O'Brien's counsel knew that there was another potential source of indemnification for the arbitration expenses, and that was IAC. And the reason we know that, and I can point you to his summary judgment motion in the Florida trial court where he references Section 5.8C of the 2000 merger agreement, saying IAC has an obligation on this as well. But again, the testimony in the record is he knew IAC was a potential source. He didn't pursue IAC in Florida. He always knew it was out there. And he thought, well, I have three shots, and this is Mr. Hunt's testimony. I have three shots against PRC. I have the indemnification agreement. I have Florida law. And I have PRC certificate of incorporation. Oh, and you know, if I'm going to sue IAC, I probably have to go to Delaware unless they waive that and appear here. So he made that calculation knowing he had a claim in April 2005, and it was only after the bankruptcy filing in January of 2008 that, and I think this is critical, that he said, oh, wait a second, I may not recover completely from PRC. I have a claim against IAC, and in fact, at the time PRC filed in January 2008, he still had 3 months to file a timely claim. He waited 6 months.
One last question, at least from me, about the record. It's a follow-up to Justice Holland's. The claim is made here that IAC was basically the puppeteer pulling the strings, controlling all the moves that PRC made defensively in the Florida litigation. Is that the fact? At least as far as the record.
Again, there isn't any question, Your Honor, that IAC was aware and had knowledge of what was going on.
We know it was aware and had knowledge. The question is, was it causing PRC to do whatever it did defensively?
I think to some extent it was. PRC had separate in-house counsel. It had separate officers. It had separate board. But there were officers at IAC who were, you know, involved in decisions relating to the litigation.
And the answer is yes, they were controlling.
Yes, but the point that I think is critical is that Mr. O'Brien has never argued that therefore arrests the statute of limitations against IAC. And to the contrary, we've cited a number of cases in our brief which make it very clear that the assertion of a claim against a parent does not operate to arrest the limitations against a subsidiary and vice versa. You have to, that's litigation 101, you have to name all parties against whom you seek to claim claim recovery. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and recess.
Aye.